Acme Radio, live from Music City, USA.
Hello again, this is Barry Mazur on Acme Radio from Lower Broad in Nashville, Tennessee, with a new edition of Roots Now. In this show, we home in on American music with a past, present, and a future from a town where so much of it keeps coming along. Our special guest today is singer-songwriter, song interpreter, guitar whiz, and occasional actor, Webb Wilder. He's been a core player on the edgier side of this town for decades, from the era of his first album, It Came From Nashville, of the mid-80s, through his current release, Mississippi Modern. But first, sampling of two new releases in the spectrum of Roots Now that I think you'll want to hear. Buddy Miller has a new album out, Kayamo Sessions at Sea, recorded on the annual Americana cruise of that name. From that set, Buddy and the spiky Nashville country singer Nikki Lane take on a classic, the much-missed Music City hero Cowboy Jack Clement, in the duet style of Porter and Dolly. This is Just Someone I Used to Know from Buddy and Nikki on Roots Now.
One, two, three.
Jazzier and the blues on the West Coast, Kim Nally has a new small combo album out recently, Blues People, which includes both topical originals, such as her protest song Ferguson Blues, and also a terrific take on a song first introduced by B.B. King. This is That One, Kim Nally with Never Make Your Move Too Soon on Roots Now.
One, two, three, four.
There was
weekly feature, Play It Forward, where we follow some great lasting American roots music sound or song across the decades and listen to hear history happen. This week, we'll get into a song which has wended its way through so many American roots and pop genres and says what it says so well that to me, it's practically the alternative American national anthem. The song is Trouble in Mind, written by jazz piano player Richard C. Jones in the 1920s while he was working as a producer for OK Records. It would become a tune especially loved near the corner of jazz and country, and let's play that forward. First up, with Jones himself on piano and Louis Armstrong on cornet from 1926, this is vaudeville blues singer Bertha Chippy Hill with Trouble in Mind. It had reached swinging country players. This is Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys with Tommy Duncan on the vocal from 1936. Dinning sisters split their time between harmonious country and jazzy pop. Here they are in 1951 with the great George Barnes on guitar.
I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad line. Let the 2:30 train relax my troubled mind.
In the 60s folk revival, backwoods Roscoe Holcomb took Trouble High and Lonesome into the banjo. Franklin brought the song into soul in no mean terms in 1965. And Leon Russell, backed by Willie Nelson and Bonnie Raitt, no less, came together around this country and blues rock anthem in 1989. Made this all-country version one of his last turn-of-the-century American recording.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's gonna shine round my back door someday. I'm going down to the river. I'm gonna take me a rocking chair. And if the blues don't leave me, I'll rock on away from here.
Well, watch out for your state of mind when you reach that 219 train, and that's this week's Play It Forward. Our guest today, songwriting rocker Webb Wilder, has been bringing this town a mix of roots rock, blues, country, outer space, background music, and whatever else attracts his fancy for some 30 years now. So before we talk, I'll show you what I mean by whatever with an introductory anthem from his 1995 Town and Country album. You'll recognize it, I think. It once served as theme music for celebrated golfer and model painter Auric Goldfinger. Some roots music for the gang up at Fort Knox. Webb, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barry.
And congratulations on being admitted to the Mississippi Musicians Hall of Fame. You did resist calling the new record "It Came from Mississippi," I noticed.
Yeah, I guess that's one yet, you know, that we could use. We used "It Came from Nashville" way back in the day at a time when people would say, if you're not playing country music, don't tell them you're from Nashville, because there was the what I call the hillbilly stigma.
Absolutely.
You know, don't tell us what to do, I guess. So we called it Came from Nashville.
We may finally be overcoming that. Not that there's anything wrong with the hillbilly.
Well, the benefit of the hillbilly stigma was people weren't moving here in droves and causing us the traffic problems we now have. So I miss the hillbilly stigma for that reason. The funny thing is people are now waking up to what we always knew, that there's every kind of music here. It is, after all, Music City. It's just the CMA had more money to promote itself.
You know? Well, that's the beauty of it. And I want to get into that a little bit with you in the course of this hour, but there's a Hattiesburg guy side to the songs taken up on Mississippi Modern, the new record. So what drew you kind of back to that neighborhood now?
Well, I realized the album before that accidentally was a bit of a concept album, and that's another story. And how this album really came together as well as it did is a little bit of luck and accident. I am who I am, and there is a certain trajectory to accumulating songs and influences for songs. And I think that every journey begins with a single step. So we recorded the first two songs and sort of took a pause, and Joe McMahon's studio burned, literally.
How
How long ago was that?
This was quite a few years
that'll
ago.
That'll set somebody back.
Yeah, he's up and running bigger and better than ever and is a great talent. We had Lucy May Blues and we had Yard Dog. Mm. And so then you kind of go, okay, this is because Joe had sort of thought, maybe this album you should really kind of wave a garage rock flag. And I said, well, I know a great garage rock cover, and it's so obscure, and no one's ever done it except the original artist. And, of course, it was Yard Dog by the One Way Street. People may not hear it in our version, but if you hear the original version, that band at that time was taking a big cue, as many people did, from Roy Head's Treat Her Right. So it's kind of a blue-eyed soul thing. Lucy May Blues is a blues song.
You almost can't help being in the Mississippi Territory when you start picking the numbers like that.
Yeah, so you start saying, that's kind of the way this is going, and then that guided the...
Here's another one from Mississippi Morning, a funky one, with some useful advice written by Webb, with co-writers Patrick Sweeney and John Hadley. This one is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, on Roots Nick. First began to record and get some attention in the 80s. For all the sorts of music you play, it seemed like people tend to describe you at the time as a rockabilly, at heart at least. Mm-hmm. Is that a reasonable description of what you do, or is there no reasonable description of what you do?
I think it was a reasonable description, although not 100% accurate, of that first album.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all they had to go by. But I had a little bit of a reaction, for lack of a better word, to being suddenly pigeonholed as rockabilly.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think it was right, for one thing. It is not what I wanted to just do. I didn't want to just stay there.
It kind of locks you into that world. And there is a world of rockabilly.
There is.
Revival. Yeah.
And I love it. And I don't know, though. It's an Afro-Celtic culture down in Mississippi, so I had to honor the other side of it.
The rockabilly revivalists often stick to the slamming numbers from back in the day, but you do something else on this record, reviving one of Conway Twitty's hit rockabilly ballads, which used to exist in this world. So let's hear that. This is Webb Wilder with Lonely Blue Boy on Roots Now. Like a creative surge in Nashville in 2016, right now, with a guy like producer Dave Cobb working, for example. We were over at his Revive Studio A, you and I, just a few weeks ago. Yeah. There's people working exciting areas that bust the boundaries between all these different schools of music in town here. Roots rock, Americana, country. You know, it's not, the lines are not as obvious, which is to me a good thing. And it brings some exciting music and artists to the foreground. You were here 30 years ago, 1986, is what Steve Earle used to call the great credibility scare.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was all kinds of artists, Mavericks, Kelly Willis, Foster and Lloyd, Lyle Lovett, Nancy Griffith, getting signed as country acts. And in the same place, there were people like yourself and Jason and the Scorchers playing rock, and there was hardly any line drawn between those acts, except by the labels.
Right.
So You were active then, you're active now. How would you compare the environment in Nashville of 1986 and 2016?
Well, they have things in common, and there are things that are very different.
Yeah.
And I think that hillbilly stigma thing we talked about earlier is something that's different. You know, Jason Isbell is so big in Americana that you'd almost call him a pop sensation, you know, because he's huge in Americana. He's spilled over to...
The potential's been there.
Yeah, and now and they're even acknowledging and dragging him into country a little bit. You know, I don't know if he wants to be dragged there or not, although he would benefit that scene. But that kind of thing wasn't happening in the country world, in the industrial strength music row country world 30 years ago here. But there was the great credibility scare. So you did have Tony Brown at MCA signing Steve Earle, for instance.
A lot of it was that.
A lot of it was him. He deserves a lot of credit.
But Foster and Lloyd were on Victor at the same time. So
that's right.
There was kind of, there was this moment, you know, they were kind of trying different things. They may have been so desperate that they decided to go good. You never know.
I just remember Tony Brown coming to one of our shows. We used to do a lot in 1985. We did a lot of what people were then calling showcase gigs, you know.
Yes.
And,
which meant they weren't paying it, right?
Yeah. Well, it just meant, yeah, it, sometimes. But
certain people were supposed to see it. But
you never made a lot of money playing in Nashville or in Austin or in New York. You know, where it's happening, there's always too much competition for people to make money unless they're just really packing the joint. Anyway, he was friendly and he came to the gig. And I don't know, there was a guy that'll go unnamed who was thinking maybe we could be the next Alabama. And we were thinking like, really? I mean, do you realize we have a song called Horror Hayride? You know, so there was some miscommunication. But what I always say at this point when this kind of thing comes up is wave a big flag and give credit to Praxis International.
Yes.
Because anything that was really not going to be embraced by
this
the country.
This was a label and a public.
Well, they were a label for a little while, but they quickly became
management. Company.
Management.
Yeah.
And what they really ultimately wanted to do was be the A&R branch of or satellite division of a major, which they eventually did with BMG with a label called Zoo. And we were on that label. But it was Andy McLennan and Jack Emerson, yes, who sadly Jack is no longer with us, but his memory really lives on, and he was really a visionary.
But you and Jason,
yep,
even Steve Earle had a relationship with that organization.
Right.
Yeah.
After Praxis dissolved, Steve Earle, you mentioned, started the E Squared label with Jack.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. What's it done for your music in all those years between now and today that you're based here, that there's so many diverse talents to work with? What difference does it make that this is where you live and work a lot of the time?
It has made a difference in the past, I think, because of the hillbilly stigma or whatever. We were maybe kind of ignored a little bit by the larger world. But who's to say if we wouldn't have gotten lost in the shuffle in L.A. or New York or mm-hmm. somewhere? I think now, since that time, of course, all the L.A. people have moved
here.
You know, I think it's great that Jack White moved here. I think it's great that the Black Keys moved here. But they were already famous before they got here.
Yes.
You know, so there were a handful of us whose careers outside of country were launched here prior to that. And that's kind of our claim to non-fame.
As a writer, you showed up here after some time in Austin also, and happily co-writing at first, often with R.S. Field.
Yeah, I've done a lot of his songs and written a lot with him.
And the new record shows with a variety of writers to this day. There have been some periods where you didn't let it loose a new record for quite a while.
Yeah.
But you have this writes well with others thing. So this co-writing situation that's a regular part of life in Nashville, was that one of the things that kept you going and involved with the music, like long between records? You're always writing, right?
You know. No, not so much. The truth is not always what you wish the truth was. You know, and in my case, I wasn't.
What was the ugly truth?
Well, the ugly truth is I wasn't always writing.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword. I think early on, I grew up with R.S. Field. I call him Bobby Field,
yeah,
you know.
Yes.
So early on, I sort of put my writing on the back burner because his was so good. And you know, we'd write together, of course, and then he'd write with other people, and I'd record those songs too. And then he would always, and I both would look outside of our own writing for songs. You know, he was about to produce Sonny Landreth all those years ago and got me new landlord. I recorded it before Sonny, you know, and
You had the devil's right hand before most people out of his town had heard it from Steve Earle. Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't turn you into a songwriting date kind of guy, or did it?
It didn't. I tried a little bit of that, and I wasn't always comfortable with it, you know. I would write a little bit here and there, and I'd write some with Bobby, and I was always doing songs and doing gigs. But I reconnected with John Hadley in recent years, who had written us a song on that very first album called Poolside, which my fans have always loved that song. And so there you go. That's kind of a full circle aspect of the new record.
Here's one collaboration most any American roots music maker would be proud to have had, written by Webb and the great Dan Penn, who gave a terrific show of his own here a few months ago at City Winery.
Yes.
From Mississippi Modern, this is Only a Fool on Roots Now.
Sure which came first, but when Dan did his Do Right Man album, which came out on Sire back in the early 90s, was about the time my Doodad album had come out. And Keith Sykes had told me about Dan before I ever moved to Nashville. And by the time I met him, I knew who he was and how heavy his, you know, catalog was and everything. And we were friendly, and he actually, from his hand to mine, he gave me that Sire album. But Jack Emerson, who we mentioned earlier, actually set up the co-writing appointment for me to write with Dan. And I knew how heavy that was. I knew I wasn't writing with Joe Blow, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I went over to his house, and his wife is like the nicest person you could ever meet. And she greets me at the door, and I go in. So we sit down, and I said, what do you want to do? What do you want to write? And right away, he knew. Dan speaks kind of like a gunfighter. He doesn't mince his words. You know, he said, he doesn't have a low voice, but it somehow carries this gravitas, you know. And he said, well, I've been wanting to write a song called Only a Fool.
Let's do it.
Yeah, because, you know, no irony, straight ahead. And I said, well, I've got this lick. and then boom. So we wrote the song, and I did kind of a homemade demo of it. And that's as far as it got for kind of decades. I mean, that may have been, I'd like to know how many years ago that was, 25 or something.
Yeah, we're talking about a different era, but it's just out, this record.
Yeah, we didn't, so no one recorded it until now. And Tom Comet and Bob Williams and Jimmy Lester were great on it, and we did it.
We've been talking about the root side of this so much, which is natural for this show and for you. But I may not have made it clear that your band, and you have performed songs over the years from Mott the Hoople, the Small Faces, the Kinks. There's a hard rock and even sometimes pop side to this. So if I'd been at your house in high school, what would I have actually found on the Wilder home record player?
I'm so glad you put it that way, because that, I can tell you, you know, you would have probably seen, you know, Free, Fire and Water, the band, and their subsequent several albums. An album that keeps coming back for me is the Everly Brothers Sing Great Country Hits. I've had that since elementary school.
It seems still to be affecting people.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly, I just saw where Long Player by The Faces was released 40-something years ago. That would have been there, or Every Picture Tells a Story. Those albums all meant a lot to me, and I had NRBQ's first album on 8-track in my first car. You which had been do, mom's car.
You still?
No, I don't have the 8-track. I have the vinyl.
Let's step back to one of those numbers that you did write with R.S. Field, which is pretty hooky, very nearly pure pop, and in a good way. So this is from Webb's 1996 Acres of Suede album. This is No Great Shakes on Roots Now. some of the numbers you've dug up from back home may not be that familiar to some people, even down in Mississippi. By this point, I'm thinking of something like Jimmy Swan's old school Honky Tonkin' in Mississippi, which is a small label record that didn't go too far, and one of my other life jobs working for the state of Mississippi on Country Markers, I know him from. But how do you pick something like that? It seems like you must do some pretty deep research yourself in a way.
Yeah, sometimes it's deep, sometimes it's shallow, but going way back when we would make a record, RS produced so many records on me, and I can remember, you know, we'd have X number of original songs and we'd need something else. We'd literally start just going through our record collections.
Yeah.
But in the case of Jimmy Swan, he lived in Hattiesburg, and he had
DJ, a politician of sorts, and
yeah, he ran for governor on what was, there's no way else of saying it,
the segregationist,
yeah, segregationist ticket. His son was a local newscaster or weatherman, but I met him because he was the landlord of this house that some of the guys in Bobby Fields' band rented, and he also had recorded for my Aunt Lillian on her trumpet label way back.
Yes, then. Yes. Which is, for people who don't know, that's one of the great Mississippi record labels in blues, and in this case, country. So let's hear that from Webb's 2009 album, More Like Me. This is Honky Tonkin' in Mississippi on Roots Now.
All night long. And honky tonk all night long. Out all night, ain't doing no harm.
Was this guy who even years later in the 60s was making records that sounded like the early 50s. So he's kind of retro himself, but the music was good, even if the political platform was sucky.
Right. Yeah, he had a style and he stuck with it. And his singing style was very like Hank Sr.'s. So I sort of, first off all, I thought he was a super footnote. And then when I was working for XM doing my radio show out of the Country Music Hall of Fame. They have a gift shop.
Yeah.
I saw where Bear Family had done a huge box set on Jimmy Swan.
They have all it, yeah.
So periodically, I'll go back and do a little Jimmy Swan homework, you know. And I stumbled on something on the internet that, first of all, you know, he sounded like Hank Sr., okay. And he was on my aunt's trumpet label, but he was also on MGM, which was Hank's label. I just figured he did that because he wanted to be Hank, you know. But he was from Alabama. Hank was from Alabama. And the information I stumbled on said that Hank played in Jimmy's band at one time. And I wondered, wow, instead of, you know, maybe Hank sounded like Jimmy.
We'll never know because there's Hank stories. But
it's very appropriated Johnny Johnston style. You know?
Who knows? But that leads me right into another thing that you have going on Mississippi Modern. I mean, for people who don't know, the trumpet label that your aunt ran was one of the great blues labels of the Deep South. And Mississippi Modern begins and ends with a risky sort of deep blues number, Stones in My Pathway, which is not Robert Johnson's Stones in My Pathway, but kind of sounds like somebody who's been singing almost that long when we hear it on the record. So it's certainly a deep blues loop. What was the idea there?
You know, the idea was not an idea. It was a subconscious thing coming through, which is where great, I don't know that that's great, but where your artistic inspirations come from. And I think sometimes we edit out our own best impulses.
Yeah.
So you can't make this stuff up. This is true. We drew a couple of these recordings from our own vaults. You know, they weren't new, but they'd never been released. And then in the case of the Dan Penn song, we wrote it years ago, but didn't record it until recently. So anyway, I was literally singing in the shower in the mid-90s. This is true. And I started making that up. And I'm sure that phrase, I had seen the Robert Johnson title or something and thought pathway instead of passway because it just seems more common. And I thought I was a hold of something, and I got out of the shower and I put it down on a little cassette. And it just so happened that day I was, this is in the 90s, the mid-90s, yeah. I was going over to George Bradfute's house, and he's always had a home studio. And I knew Keith Richards had recorded on cassette and blown the guitar over to the multitrack for Street Fighting Man. I said, hey, can we put this on your multitrack? He said, yeah.
And we got it today, right?
Yeah, and so
from the shower to our ears, this is Webb Wilder with Stones in My Pathway on Roots Now.
Stone in my pathway. Except the Lord, stone in my pathway.
So towards the end of the show like this, Webb, we like to play a record or two by other artists that I have reason to figure are of interest to our guest. In this case, it's a pair of numbers that you take on yourself on Mississippi Martin. First, whether it's always been a favorite of yours or you were reminded of it by the ongoing Sam Phillips exhibit over at the Country Hall of Fame, this is another song about a fool. From Sun Records, 1960, this is Charlie Rich with Who Will the Next Fool Be? I'm sure you have many times, as I have. What do you hear in there, in that singer and that song?
Well, I love Charlie Rich. I think he was an American original, and American originals have roots. They don't come from nowhere, but he was, what I relate to about him is he wasn't just one thing. You know, he was hillbilly, he was blues, he was jazz.
They didn't know where to put him for a long time.
What now?
They didn't know where to put him for
a long time. No, they didn't. And of course, he'd had the pop hits, you know, with before his Silver Fox era. But did Sam Phillips produce that? Was that done here in Nashville? It was like 60,
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
It was a Sun studio.
It was at the very end of the Sun days. Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, I think that song owes a little bit of a debt to songs like Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out or Give Me a Pig Foot.
He knew all those.
Because it wasn't just three-chord type blues.
Not at all. Yeah. No, no. But we're going to get to one that's a little closer, also taken up on the new record by you and your band, The Beatniks. From 1958, the hard-hitting Chicago blues innovator Otis Rush with It Takes Time.
Try to make it a home, but oh, yeah, you know what it means to be alone.
difference in that case is performance can be separated from the song or not, but what grabbed you about that one? That is certainly not Stones in My Bath.
I'll tell you, I'm so glad we finally recorded it, but there are a lot of, almost on a track-by-track basis, I could tell you that there's some full circles aspect to each of the songs on this album. And in the case of that one, I was in a band called The Drapes in Mississippi before I moved to Nashville. And I moved to Nashville in 82, right? The Drapes was like every band I'd been in up until that point where I wasn't the only lead singer.
Yeah.
You know, that's what really changed when I came to Nashville. So there was another guitar player, singer, who loved the blues, Rick Casper Rawls, who lives out in Austin now. But he had moved to Mississippi. We had met him during our Texas years. He moved down there to be in a band with me and some other people. And he loved Eric Clapton. Mm-hmm. And Eric Clapton loves Otis Rush.
Sometimes vocally he sounds just like him. Yes.
There you go. And so Casper did a couple of Otis Rush songs in our set, and that was one of them. But we developed a different kind of harder, kind of a more rock feel for it. We featured his guitar, but I played that bump, da-da-da rhythm. I don't even know why or where that came from. And so after the Drapes broke up, you know, I'd pull it out with my band as a blue, minor key blues song. And over the years, we kept doing it and just loved doing it. So we'd been doing it for years on stage before we finally recorded it.
Well, it's electric and real swell on this new record.
Thanks.
And we're about out of time, but I want to thank you for being here, Webb.
My pleasure.
Speaking of the web, you can learn more about this record and others at webwilder.com. That's WEBBWILDER.com. For Roots Now producer and engineer Justin Hamill and me, Barry Mazur, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be back next week.